One of my favorite people in the world is Steve Cockrum. We just have so much in common. Steve, amazing to have you with me here on Culture Matters. Today we're going to talk about Britain, British-American relationships. We're going to talk about British colonization. We're going to talk about your cultural transition when you come into the U.S., all of those cool things. Steve is the co-founder of Giant Worldwide, a leadership training group, co-author of Five Voices, Five Gears, and now you have a very successful book called 100 Time Leader. Amazing to have you with me, man. Great to talk with you.
Ricardo, you are so kind. You've spent far too long in America, my friend. That was one of those gushing introductions that leaves me absolutely nowhere to go but down, basically.
You guys are doing great. And you just started Giant TV, which is really cool. Yeah. Neat platform. So,
we're a SaaS business now. It's kind
you
of
are. You and Jeremy Kubitschek, who I'm going to have here, I think, in the next 2 or 3 weeks to talk about organizational culture. There but I don't want to talk about organizational culture.
Come on.
Here's what I want to talk about. There are 200 countries that are, I think, represented in the United Nations, right? And then there's one, like, observing country. Like, out of those 201, Great Britain or England has in some way had military presence or colonization of 171 of them at some at some point in history. So like my first ridiculous, crazy cultural question is, what's with the British, like, historically, that they just wanted to colonize everybody?
Well, I think there's something about humility in calling ourselves Great Britain. It's almost making Britain great again should be the new slogan of the next campaign, but we won't go there. I think the reality is if you think of how empires were built and how they fell, I would say that virtually all of ours, the real power came from the Industrial Revolution. So it was economic might and the power of the British Navy. So being basically an island state meant that we were always great sailors. And effectively, there was a moment when the sun never didn't set on the British Empire. We basically worked out how to do global trade, and we leveraged really the wealth of the Industrial Revolution to effectively control without necessarily having to conquer. Others had different models of how they did it, but we really used trade as best we could. And the great thing is we exported cricket, railways, and British law. They were the three great exports of the British Empire, and of course the ability to drink all day and to play any sport that involves sitting down for a long period of time. You look at the Olympics, we're geniuses at anything that involves sitting down because we had nothing to do all day while we ran the empire.
Oh my. We could stop the interview now and it would just have unbelievable value. What I learned from Steve, just sitting down with Steve, you know, the times where you and I just come away mesmerized. So, like, that was really cool. That was awesome.
I always say I'm a lot brighter than I look on a podcast.
Well, that's why we don't. That's why we don't publish the videos. For those who are listening, we actually do these on video so we can see each other, but we don't publish the videos. So let's talk about, like, Great Britain's relationship now with India, because India was a British colony, right? And so India still has a prime minister. They still have essentially the British legal system, correct? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what's the relationship? Because I had Sangram Vajray on and we were talking about this, right? And so I was really, like, interested in this. What's the relationship now with Great Britain and with India after they achieved their independence, which I believe came through Gandhi, right?
So I can speak from a British point of view, and I would say there is deep affection for India. I think almost all of us here now, it's not we're apologetic about the empire, but it probably feels like that did its course, and we hopefully left some things which have helped India make that transition. But it's very much growing up as a nation now and is increasingly almost not wanting aid. It's wanting to stand on its own feet. It's wanting to move into a different level of kind of status in the world. And I think that's, from our point of view, inherently a good thing. I think being part of, you know, the Commonwealth, that's a kind of another global network, which really is a legacy of the Commonwealth. But we've had difficulty in the UK because immigration has been an issue. Yes. And because we've been part of the European Union, we, in theory, have had unlimited immigration from any European Union member for the last X number of years. Well, of course, it's very, very politically difficult for a government to have unlimited immigration when the statistics are saying, they're saying we'd like to keep it to net 150,000, but everyone knows it's a lot more than that. So what's really happened is it's got harder for non-EU nationals to get visas to come to England. So South Africa, India, Canada, America, all of our historic Commonwealth partners and members have in many ways been a victim, I think, or at least a consequence of, you can't have unlimited immigration from the EU and also have generous immigration from other parts of the world and the Commonwealth. So, you know, we're right in the middle of this Brexit conversation at the moment, which we may come to at some point. But one of the hopes would be is that actually once we're able to control immigration, you know, we're talking about using an Australian style point system so that we can actually decide what does the country need, and then for what is a proportionate amount of refugees that we need to take as a compassionate member of the global community. At least let's be honest and basically say, what number do we believe we can really deal with being an island with a historic, generous social provision of healthcare, of education, of all the things that really have made Britain such a attractive destination point. But you get to a point where you either go, we need to massively increase our infrastructure, or we begin to lose something of what it was that made Britain, Britain. And I think there's a real, you know, a huge cultural identity question of going, well, what does it mean to be Britain in the new world? I think we just about got over saying sorry for everything that we did wrong, but a lot of our students now are in many ways revisiting history and saying Cecil Rhodes was part of the colonization of South Africa. We don't want Cecil Rhodes statues up in Oxford.
Are you going through that as well in Great Britain?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, very much so.
In the US, right?
So it's almost like going, you're judging people by today's standards, things that happened 200 years ago.
Right.
So I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that's a very live debate at the moment. And I think, if I'm honest, I think us hosting the Olympics in London was one of those moments where it was okay to be proud to be British again and welcome the world to our doors. I think it was a psychologically a big thing to think, okay, we've paid our penance for all of our colonial. We've really, in many ways, created a way for them to have independence and let them go. Now it's kind of a new era and a new beginning, and we're still in that, I think, at the moment, Ricardo.
But you're not giving up the British Virgin Islands, right? You guys are keeping those, right?
To the best of my knowledge. The other one, which for some reason we've decided to keep, is the Falkland Islands.
Yes, yeah, so off the coast of Argentina.
Right? On the grounds that they are about 4,000 miles away from where we are and about 100 miles off the coast of Argentina, one would perhaps suggest that actually there might have been a more appropriate way of reallocating those. But after the Falklands War of 81, I think it would be difficult to give them back now, having actually had to go and fight for them. But there we go. That's politics for you.
Well, but it makes sense that islanders would want to keep the islands, right? So,
well, you're obviously we'd like to keep most things, and you know, I think the you can always tell, Ricardo, where Britain had the biggest influence, because they still play cricket.
Yes, India.
So, India are the powerhouse globally for cricket in the world. Australia, yeah. New Zealand, West Indies, you know, Bangladesh. I mean, the reality is Zimbabwe. All of those countries play cricket. That was one of the great, and they'll probably also drink tea at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
But do you still play cricket in Great Britain?
Oh, absolutely. It's huge.
Because I know you play football, like Americans say soccer, right?
But yes, it's football. No, it's our summer sport, and we've just had the World Cup. Now, obviously, Americans, in cricket here this summer, which was just amazing, and England won it. We won the World Cup.
Did you really?
We won it this year.
Or who's the other powerhouses in cricket?
India would be one of them. Australia would be another. But it's pretty even. We beat New Zealand in the final, went down to the last ball of the last over. Now, you know, Test match cricket. We then played the Australians for the Ashes, and this is one which, if you can imagine, a game of sport which goes on for 5 days. Okay. 5 days that starts at 11 in the morning and goes to 6:30 every evening, with a little break for lunch, a little break for afternoon tea. And at the end of 5 days, you can still have a draw. it violates every principle of all of my American friends.
It does violate the principles of American winning. No one wants to tie. So we actually asked this question. We have I did this at Coca-Cola last week in an event that we did there. And so we have this like world culture knowledge, like just to get people to realize we really don't know much about world cultures, right? Mm-hmm. And so we asked them about who's like the most famous ever Indian cricket player, you know, and we'd frame it up. We go, now remember, India is the second most populous country in the world, right?
Yes.
Three times as many people as in the United States. So it's kind of an important country, you know, and nobody knows the answers to these questions, right?
Well, I would.
So I'm going to ask you.
Yeah, come on. Cricket is my passion.
Who is like the most famous Indian cricket player? Give me two or three.
So you probably have Sunil Gavaskar from one generation.
Okay.
You'd have the little master, Sachin Tendulkar.
That's the one we put on the answer to the quiz, right?
And probably Virat Kohli right now is the one that's coming up on. But the little master, Sachin Tendulkar, would be probably the most well-known, respected. Literally, he has an apartment in London to get away from.
You got one out of 10. Shall I give you the other nine questions?
Come on, let's do it.
No, because let's stay on India. How many states are in India?
Oh, good Lord. Four.
Okay.
Come on then.
Okay, who's the goalie for the Mexican soccer team?
Gosh, I've absolutely no idea. No idea.
So we know so much about culture and we know so little about world cultures, right?
As I've just proved. So there we go.
Oh, so I have a really good one for you. In what country is it an offense to ask for salt at the table?
I'll go Israel.
Egypt.
Okay, well, I was close.
I mean, the Israelis came out of Egypt, right?
Moses. There you go.
So
did people know the answer to these regards?
Oh, nobody knows the answers.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Fine. So the beauty of it is everybody sits there. It's like, I do this at the beginning, you know, and everybody sits there and goes, well, I guess I should listen.
Yeah.
You know, I guess I don't know as much as I, and you and I know each other. So I'll tell you the story. So, I'm white, right? I'm one of those white Hispanics. And even the U.S. Census now, they actually have a checkbox. It's not just for Hispanic. Now it's like, are you white Hispanic? Because everything's so color driven. Right?
Yes.
So I was doing this conference last year at AT&T in Dallas. And a lady comes up to me afterwards, an African-American woman. And she says, I owe you an apology. And I said, why? And she said, well, I walked in and I saw this white guy and he's going to teach on culture. And I walked out and I thought to myself, what in the world is this white guy going to teach me about culture? She was so transparent, you know.
That's lovely.
But yeah, it was really a refreshing moment, you know. And she said, well, I was wrong. And I said, well, wonderful, you know. And we have in the U.S. we have equated culture with color, and it's a huge mistake. So I always tell people, white people have culture too, you know. You have culture in Great Britain, so let's talk about the king, queen, and the royal family.
Yes.
So what I'm interested in knowing about the royal, do they really still have a lot of influence on what actually happens in Great Britain politically, or are they just really truly figureheads? What's the relationship of the royal family?
Yeah.
Real politics?
So the reality is that we have an unwritten constitution, which functions on precedent. So in some ways, the Americans are always arguing and amending the constitution, whereas we don't have one. And the reality is, in theory, everything exists around the monarchy. So the prime minister is the first minister of the monarch. The church function as on behalf of the monarch, but she has no power. So it's this fascinating kind of dynamic that the royals have no influence at all on politics per se, officially. But actually, the Queen is one of the most incredible women. I mean, you know, to be working at 93, she's been monarch for so long. She is now, I think it might be 14 prime ministers, and every week they have an audience with her. So she's a source of wisdom. Yeah, it's part of the fabric of how British society and culture works. So whenever we have a new parliament, a new session of parliament, you have all this finery of where Black Rod comes and knocks on the doors of the Commons, summons the people from the lower house to come to the upper house, where the Queen announces in all this regalia that basically a new parliament is sitting. And there is what they call a Queen's speech, which outlines the, in many ways, the policies that are going to be tried and brought forward by the government in the next session of parliament. So there is a huge interweaving of church, state and politics at the and law at the very center of how the country functions. And we're even asking the question now is, well, should we, do we need a constitution? Because historical precedent, which has underpinned hundreds of years of law, is currently being used because Brexit is such a divisive issue.
Right.
That both sides believe ideologically they are right and are doing everything in their power to make sure that what they think is best for the country happens. And the Queen, to some degree, is a bit caught in the middle of this at the moment. So it's very, very live right now. And I don't think anybody really knows how the dust will settle. But the monarchy, Ricardo, is the most stable institution. I mean, it's survived everything. I mean, it's where other monarchies around Europe got taken down by the, you know, the French, we got rid of theirs a long time ago. The British monarchy has been the most incredibly stable institution. And every time they talk about its demise, it just finds a way to work its way through, because ultimately the whole of British society runs on a class system model, and patronage from the Queen or an award or an invitation almost has a hypnotic kind of way of getting people in power to conform, because they all would like to be involved in some way, whether they're in the House of Lords, whether they're given a Knight of the Garter, whether they have an MBE, a CBE, an OBE. All of these awards are given by the Queen to reward who knows what and who gets them. But it's just the most phenomenal way of keeping the whole class ecosystem in its place. It's just genius. And it's been, don't forget, we've been an unconquered nation for 1,000 years. So if you think how much law, history, confidence, financial, and London is the absolute epicenter of power, you and the Americans have been at least spread out their federal dollars. So even North Dakota got a missile shield, and Omaha got air defense, and everyone gets something. Yeah. Whereas in England, if you think London, in the space of a square mile, you have the epicenter of government, the epicenter of monarchy, the epicenter of law, and really the center of finance in the world. So all roads lead to London.
Is Churchill still revered in England?
Do you know, he is actually. I think of all the leaders who's, in some ways, whether it's a Me Too movement type backlash against what they did, I would say that Churchill probably still comes out as the person who is respected most. And in many ways, he had his idiosyncrasies. We've had some films recently that have portrayed him perhaps probably more like he was, I suspect. But I think fundamentally there was this Churchillian spirit, bulldog spirit, the fact that basically without Churchill, we wouldn't have really fought the war. I mean, you've got to remember that the royal family were, they changed their name. Most of the royal family had relatives in Germany. They were actually looking for a negotiated peace in many ways rather than fight. So Churchill was the one who stood up and said, guys, we'll fight them on the beaches, we'll do all those things, and really rallied a nation to fight for something that no one believed we could win. I mean, even the Americans didn't believe we could win the war.
Right.
I mean, they were already trying to work out what would happen and how would they negotiate. You know, they sent us food and stuff across the water. But if you look at it, there was a moment when only a very few people ever believed we could win that war. So I think Churchill was given, he was one of the only two people, I think, as commoners who was given a state funeral. There's no huge skeletons in his cupboard, apart from the fact he drank an awful lot and, you know, he used to sleep till whatever
those
his morning.
Those were different days, right, Steve?
Totally.
I think to go back and, you know, there's just something to be said from, obviously, from learning from history and recognizing that we're in a different place culturally today. But to deny reality or to deny that, you know, those people for their time, you know, they got there honestly, right? Even people today, I mean, everybody got to exactly where they're at. You know, they were formed by their cultures. I always tell people, if you were born in Iraq or Afghanistan or Turkey, you know, the statistical probability that you're Muslim is over 99%.
Yes.
I mean, it's the power of culture. Mm-hmm. And I think to negate whatever those cultures were, I think it's a huge mistake. It mm-hmm. just takes the moorings. It takes the anchor out of a society.
I mean, I couldn't, I think the reality is, in the, they created the United States of America because they were united in language, in currency, and common opposition. They are united in the sense that they had a common language, a common right. currency, and a common enemy. So in some ways, they left, you know, they left England and other parts of Europe to escape, in many ways, the feudal system and the class system for a new opportunity. And obviously, for a while, we tried to run it as a colony. And in the end, we had a little episode with a tea party in the harbour, and, you know, we lost one of our best tax revenues for the last 300 years. But, you know, the reality is, it's not, I believe, that's why I think the European issue is such a challenge, because we're trying to bring together cultures which are thousands of years in the development, with different languages, with different currencies, with different histories. So I guess the question of whether...
Does it feel forced? Does it
feel... Yes. So for me, it's like the original intent of the European economic area was, how do we actually trade together? How do we do things together for the common good? How do we protect each other? How do we collaborate on things without losing the individualism of the nation state? So my own personal view is, it's very, very difficult to bring. We're never going to create a United States of Europe, because fundamentally we come from a different heritage of language, economics, and in many ways we don't have a common enemy. On the whole, we've been each other's enemies on and off for the last X thousand years. And so therefore, it's almost like you watch it with sport. I mean, I don't know what it's like with you over there, but actually when you watch football, people take huge pride in the cultural identity of their team. And actually, for me, it's how do you celebrate the diversity of culture and really celebrate it and look, what can we do together to collaborate? Because we obviously don't want another war like we had 70 years ago. But the question is, human beings are creatures of overreaction in most things. So in some ways to go, I think it's possible for us to collaborate on things without actually having to try and create a homogenous culture. America still struggles. But if you think about it, nobody questions that, you know, New York or California actually subsidizes some of the southern states through taxation because some of those southern states are not as wealthy. Well, if you look at European Union, Germany and the rich countries are not prepared to subsidize, i.e. underwrite the debts of France, Portugal, Spain, Italy, Greece. So therefore, you can't have political union without economic union. And that's, I think, going to be one of those fundamental tensions which nobody's going to resolve. My prediction, so, you know, if you really want to go with this one, is to say one of two things will have to happen, both of which are allegedly impossible. But one of them will have to happen eventually. Either Germany will have to underwrite the debts and liabilities of all the other nations in the European Union, or there will be a breakup of the European Union.
You bring up something that's fascinated me, and that's the homogenization of cultures. And, you know, it's easy when you talk about celebrating the diversity of cultures. Mm. In a culture, there are five elements, right? So you have beliefs and values and norms and symbols and language. So the easiest things to celebrate are symbols and language, right? Mm. Because those are kind of the visual, those are the things that are out front. But where cultures get in problems is when their values and their norms and their beliefs kind of hit up against each other, and that's when people really start to fight. And so I'm a believer that people need to learn to become culturally endeared towards other cultures without at the same time giving up their own culture. Mm. But sometimes people get into this position where they believe so strongly that their beliefs, values, and norms are the only ones that are correct. Mm. Right? And you said on a couple occasions, I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I have that view of culture. Mm-hmm. Culture is. So what may be right for one culture is not necessarily right for another culture. We've made culture kind of a moral issue. Mm-hmm. rather than an understanding that culture is simply the outworking of the people's experience, right? You know, people drive culture. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really concerned, not so much about symbols and language within a culture, because I think people, you know, you have a festival, right? Like, let's celebrate XYZ culture. And so you have folkloric dance, you have music, you have food, you have somebody speaking in that language. Well, those are all symbols and language, right? Mm-hmm. But where it gets tricky is, now let's talk about our beliefs. Yeah. And now let's talk about our values. And now let's talk about our norms, right? And that's where I think people really struggle with culture, because we are so black and white. We are so right and wrong. Mm. And that's where, at least in the US, we're in such big trouble from an ideological standpoint.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we're any real better over here. There was a time when politics was actually about arguing, about debating, and about actually fighting to get to, you know, what was the right thing to do. Whereas it's become so adversarial, and actually people now are, that they speak in sound bites because they understand that that's what people get remembered. That's what goes on the news cycles. So in some senses, we don't really have, I mean, one of my big sadnesses over here is, I don't believe we have true political debate anymore about the most significant issues, because they get weaponized as politics almost immediately. At some point we have to learn how to have grown-up conversation about real life issues in an adult way. And I just despair at times of the almost like childlike behavior and the inability anymore to appear to agree to disagree in a gentle way, where ideologically we're different, but we are united in our belief that we're committed to public service for the good of our country. And, you know, from what I watch across the pond, America is adversarial, is as divided as it's ever been. And, you know, Twitter has become a sphere that we never had for communication before. So now, actually, you know, a president who doesn't believe in the kind of the independence of the news channels can go direct to the world. It's certainly a different form of diplomacy than anything we've seen over the last few thousand years. So, you know, we're learning that the whole world has changed. Digital revolution changed everything. Every area of work has been impacted by it. And we're having to write new rules because no one's been here before. And I just think it's going to take a while to settle down. And I don't immediately personally see how we get out of the mess we're in at the moment. Well, not easily anyway.
It's only going to happen. This is my personal opinion on that. It's not going to happen from the macro. It's going to happen with a movement from the people who, number one, you know, this is the whole thrust behind our cultural mastery experience and movement. And that is only culturally healthy and skilled people can actually create a culturally healthy and skilled environment.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So the parts make the whole. So we're going to have to come back down to the root of the issue. And that is, we have to get enough people, leaders, culturally healthy and skilled, if in fact we ever want to have another culturally healthy and skilled environment, because we're just creating what we are, right? Mm. And so we just have a bunch of third grade bullies out there. I did want to come back to something before, because I could talk with you. You're one of those guys that I literally, and you guys, you and I have done this, and I just talked with you forever because you're so bright. I want to come back to your book, Five Gears. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about it within the context of culture. Mm-hmm. So just very quickly, and I know you could talk a long time about Five Gears, but this is a book that Steve wrote with Jeremy Kubitschek. But tell me what the five gears are, because and just the basic principle around them. Then I have a question as it relates to them, as it relates to culture.
So. Okay. So the reality, the new world, work doesn't stop. We live in a 365, 24/7 ecosystem. So the people are always saying, how do I get more time? And what we realized was, you don't going to get more time, and it's not going to get less busy. We had to have ways in which we could be more effective with the time that we had. So we basically came up with the concept of driving a stick shift car, which some of you will know about. And each gear represents a different engagement with the world, all of which are valid. So it's not one's right or one's wrong, and you need to learn to use them all. So fifth gear is what we call focus mode, in the zone, no interruptions, maximum productivity, full on work. It's 4 o'clock and you go, oh my goodness, where did the day go? That's fifth gear, focus in the zone. Fourth gear is what we call task mode. So that's multitasking. It's work, but it's balancing email, phone calls, meetings, tasks, interruptions, doors open, people coming in and out. So fourth gear is multitasking really, but it's still in the task world. Third gear is what we call social mode. So third gear is not working. It's the ability to be appropriately present with people in a social space, might be a drinks party, might be kind of at a football game. It's the ability to go, hey, Ricardo, how are you? What's going on? We talk about being able to ask good questions, but you could go up to work or you could come down. But
are we in third? Are we in third gear right now?
We probably are, but I reckon we're probably in a bit of fourth. We're doing a bit of work. We're also doing second gear a little bit, which is what we call connect gear, which is not work. That is really where you are truly choosing to invest and go deeper in the most significant friendships that you have. So I'm actually physically, emotionally, and intellectually present at the same time. And so in third gear, I might ask you, Ricardo, how are you doing? Well, the answer is, I'm doing great. How are you doing, Steve? In second gear, it's when I say, Ricardo, how are you doing, really? And you go, phew.
We're slowing down.
I'm really struggling, blah, blah, blah. See, it's honest, it's real. You can't do it with everybody. And first gear is what we call recharge mode. So that is no work. That is basically, how do you choose to recharge the batteries? What is it that recreates you, causes you to, in many ways, not necessarily be on your own. So for me, going to the movies or playing a game of golf or going out for dinner with friends, but it's the intentional recharging of the batteries in first gear recharge mode. Then reverse is what we call responsive gear, which is the ability to say sorry when you've got it wrong. Most people lose influence because they show up in the wrong place at the wrong time in the wrong gear. And actually that's where influence diminishes. So we say, how to be present and productive when there's never enough time? Just being intentional, thinking, okay, which gear am I going into right now? And actually choosing the right gear. And particularly we'd say, the gears you struggle most with are the place you undermine your influence the most. So if you don't schedule the gears you find hardest, you will never have the influence you could. I find being a human doing easier than being a human being. I love work, vision, achievement. You don't have to teach me to work. You have to teach me how to, I jokingly say, waste time with people.
Oh, my. So here's my question. I've read Five Voices.
Yeah.
But I love Five Gears. And it was a book that was helpful for me. And I'm going to preface what I'm going to say to you with something my daughter said to me. We were at dinner one night. And I was on my phone. And my daughter, who's 12 now, looks at me. I think she was like 10 at the time. She looks at me and she says, Daddy, you're not here and you're not there. Where do you want to be?
Ooh. Yeah.
And I guess in your vernacular, she could have said, Daddy, shift into gear two, will you please?
That's right. Yeah.
You know? So do the five gears work across? Because like the Latino culture is very high context, very relational. So we're like a lot in gear two and three, right?
Yes, yes.
But getting that focus, like gear five. So have you guys contextualized to cultures with the five gears where you've been able to determine where certain cultures tend to be more, you know, they struggle more in these gears than other cultures and certain cultures. Have you guys done that work? Because if not, I'd love to do that work with you. I think I'd love to write a co-article with you or something.
Yeah, come on. I think the reality is we've found it works as a concept everywhere. So okay. Human beings get gears. It doesn't matter which world you're in. But you're absolutely right. In certain cultures, the prevailing ought and should is very different. So for example, America doesn't know how to do first gear. Everybody just works. It's much more acceptable to burn out with mental illness than be deemed to be lazy. So basically teaching people, teaching Americans how to rest and recreate is like, they think 2 days is like an extended vacation. Or they come over and stay with us in London and they literally go, we've got 5 days. We're going to do everything. You know, before dawn, they're up, they're on the train, and they literally visit everything they can see, take photos of it. They come home exhausted and rinse and repeat the following day.
And then you need a vacation.
They need a vacation, but they've got the pictures and they're good to go.
I was in Atlanta. Last fall, I went to Atlanta, and a good friend of mine who's Cuban, and we were going out for dinner. And we've known each other for years, but I hadn't seen him for like a year or 2 years. And I get in the car and the first thing he says to me is, what's the agenda for our meeting?
There you go.
And you know, I live in the Dominican Republic most of the time, so I don't have an agenda. I looked at him and I said to him in Spanish, I'll say it in English. I said to him, what are you talking about? So we're just going to go have dinner and connect together. We're just going to talk about our families. And we're just going to, you know, that's gear two, right? And he's like, he's like, let's get to four, like real quick here, you know? And
Here's the thing though. So I went to Germany and did this, okay, with gears. And I said, so how many people struggle with first gear? Nobody struggled with first gear.
In Germany?
It's like, no, it was amazing. It was like, wow, okay. So everyone's home at work, end of work, to be with the family, to be with the kids. We all go out and do our exercise. We all eat healthy. I'm like, this is amazing. Because obviously I was living in America.
Wow.
So the cultural piece is huge.
Sincerely, I want to encourage everyone to read Five Gears.
Thank you, Ricardo.
I think that if you haven't read Five Gears by Steve Cochran and Jeremy Kubitz, read it.
Thank you, my friend.
And then pick up Five Voices, but pick up Five first. And then pick up Honor Times Leaders. And before you pick up any of those, pick up the Six Stages of Cultural
Absolutely. And if you're somebody in the new world that doesn't read books anymore, you can go to giant.tv/BB and you can listen to them all for free. So there we go.
There you go.
For a month, anyway.
My guest today has been Steve, co-founder of Giant Worldwide, prolific author, speaker, and 20 IQ points higher than anybody else because of his practice. Steve, you're fascinating, man. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, my friend. Pleasure, my friend, to do this all day.